All right, we're in here for our last study in the book of Numbers, in the last six chapters. And so if you've been here with us this time, we thank you very much for your presence and going through this. Hopefully it's been beneficial to you going through this book. And looking at the last six chapters, there's a lot of events happening here that will unfold and kind of set us up for the next book in the series. Any guesses as to the next book in the series? Deuteronomy, excellent. Very good. You guys are steel traps tonight. Appreciate that. All right, so looking at the book of Numbers, we're going to be looking at chapters 31 through 36 as we go through. This is our outline that we've been using, and we're in this kind of last section here as we get to the end. We've already had the census again, and we have just some closing events. Some vengeance tonight, some vengeance happening. It all makes for a good movie, right? So that'll be a part of our study. And then finishing strong as well. So, chapter 31, we have that vengeance. Now, what did we know? What happened with the Midianites in our last time we got together? What happened with the Midianites? What's that? That was the rebellion of Korah. That's a fun story, yes. But what did those Midianites do with their... The lady. Do you remember what they did with the ladies? What the sons of Israel went off, right? And you had the daughters of the Midianites, and they were sacrificing and doing all that kind of stuff with them. And you had the plague that came about them, and then Phinehas came in and, you know, like skewered a couple people. So we had a situation where there was the situation with the Midianites. And God here, again, as we talked about last week, what was happening there with the Midianite women was done on purpose. It was intentional to deviate Israel away from God. And this text brings that out even more. So chapter 31, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites after you will be gathered to your people." So Moses is reminded that he will be soon gathered to his people. But it's in chapter 25. Let's go back there real quickly. I want you to see something from that chapter. Chapter 25. Verse 18 specifically. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor." So it was in God's mind, and what unfolded there, God knew what they were doing was intentional. It wasn't that they happened to camp near Midian and they heard the party over that was going on over in Midian and decided to go join the party. And, you know, it got out of hand. That was not, it was intentional what the Midianites did towards the Israelites. And so we read this here, how the Midianites were going to be taking vengeance upon them. Moses spoke to the people, verse 3, "Arm men from among your men for war, that they may go out against Midian, execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian." Again, it's important to note that this is the Lord's vengeance that's being done here. And they weren't taking vengeance into their own hands. How many men did they end up taking out to war? 12,000, right? 1,000 from each tribe. Which, whenever in the book of Joshua, when they start taking different cities and things like that, they take like 3,000 to go out against Ai. And we know it may not have been huge, but this may have been more forces than they actually needed, but they were going to come in and strike this area. And now this campaign, we read through what they did very quickly. What happened during this campaign? They went to war against Midian, verse 7. They killed every male. Who else did they kill here? The kings? One of these people we know, we've seen before in verse 8. Who is that in verse 8 that we've seen? He's famous for talking to a donkey. Balaam. All right. So Balaam comes around. So it appears that Balaam was involved in this. Look down and we'll skip ahead here and look at verse 16. Because these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to transgress against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So who told them it would be a good idea to go and do this and send the women in and cause them to sin? Who told them? Balaam did. Probably at a price, right? But so here's the whole story. So Balaam dies as well. Now, what did they do here when they capture everybody? Who did they leave alive? What's that? The women and children, right? They leave the women and children alive. They take the cattle. They burned all their cities that they lived in their camps with fire. They took the spoil from the prey, both man and beast, and they brought the captives and the prey and the spoil to Moses and Eleazar the priest. What's interesting, when they go out to war, Moses sent out 1,000 from each tribe to war, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, to war with them. So it was Phinehas who had that zeal for God and struck down the Midianite and the man that were doing something inappropriate. And then he is the one that goes out with them as well in this instance with trumpets and that kind of thing. And so when they come back, Moses and Eleazar the priests and all the elders of the congregation went out to meet them outside the camp. Now, why did they go outside the camp to meet them? What's that? Purity. Why is that an issue? So they killed people, right? They were unclean officially, right? They had killed people. And so they are now unclean for 7 days. Apparently, like our teacher in our senior high class didn't show up. Okay. All right. So so they were unclean for 7 days, and they had to be outside the camp. So they go outside the camp to meet them, and Moses was extremely happy with them. You did a good job. You get a golden star for what you did. What does the text tell us? Was Moses happy? Open book. No, he was not happy. Moses was not happy. Moses was very not happy. He was angry because they had brought them back. And his reasoning here is sound, right? Sound reasoning. You brought these women back that had deceived you from the beginning. Why did you bring the women? They should not have been left alive. And so they are instructed to kill every male, even among the little ones, and every woman who has known a man intimately was to be killed as well. And so all the girls were going to be spared that had not known a man. And they had to camp outside for 7 days. Whoever's killed any person, whoever's touched any slain, they would purify themselves. And not only that, not only just the purification of themselves personally, but everything that comes into the camp has to be purified. And this goes back to Numbers chapter 19. You remember the ashes of the red heifer? Remember that? I mean, I know you talk about that. You're trying to make a sports drink maybe out of ashes of the red heifer and water. But this comes into play now. The red heifer washing is what has to happen in this instance. So if you want to write out here in Numbers chapter 19, verses 11 and 12, we have this situation where they have to cleanse themselves and using that water. And so they are to be purified. And every article, leather, anything has to be purified. Now, what they also brought into, we'll talk about this in just a moment in more detail, they also brought gold and bronze and tin and lead and silver and all these kind of things. These things had to be purified by fire. So before that could come into the camp, they had to melt it down, smelt it, and into ingots or something transportable before it would be brought into camp. It had to be purified. Are we understanding the nature of what God wants around him? Like, everything must be pure. You can't just bebop into camp with whatever that's been out there. It has to be purified before it comes in the presence of God because he is there with them. And so that has to be purified. In verses 25 through 47, we have the division of the plunder. And depending on which translation you use, plunder is probably the better easier translation here. And from this, there is a division of a tax, a levy, that's been brought out. And so they count everything. And verse 28 says, "Levy a tax for the Lord from the men of war who went out to battle, 1 in 500 of the persons, and of cattle, and of donkeys and sheep." And then verse 29, "And take from their half, and give it to Eleazar the priest as an offering." So that was to give to Eleazar the priest, the high priest at the time. And then from the sons of Israel's half, 1 in 50. Draw out 1 in 50 of the persons and cattle, and give it to the Levites who keep charge of the tabernacle. And so we see again, even amongst the spoils, those things that have been brought into the camp, there's provision that's made for the Levites as well in these things. And God continues to take care not only for that, but because of the sacrifices and everything that needs to take place, these things happen. Now, if you look down in verse 32, we see what remained of the spoil. 675,000 sheep. Now, just think about this. We read through this text so quickly that they went out and they did, you know, all the hoo-ha kung fu, killing everybody in Midian, okay? But this was probably a long campaign, and it probably took a long time to gather everybody up and gather up all the animals and bring them all back, right? That's just sheep, ladies and gentlemen. 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, none of them which talked. Of human beings and of men or women who had not known men, there were 32,000 people left. 32,000 people to transport to their camp. 32,000 that you're bringing them, hiking them, feeding them all until you get there. And so it talks about the division of how those things were levied out, who got what, and for the sons of Israel, their half, and those things that were taking place. Now, in verse 48, we have an offering of atonement. There was kind of their heads were hanging as they came to Moses. The officers who were over the thousands and the captains of the thousands approached Moses in verse 48. And they came and said, "Your servants have taken census of men in war, of war who are in our charge. No man of us is missing." That is to say that nobody in this whole campaign, nobody died. That's not a common statistic, is it? And you go out to war. "So we have brought as an offering to the Lord what each man found, articles of gold, armlets, bracelets, signet rings, earrings, necklaces, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. Moses and Eleazar the priest took the gold from them, all kinds of wrought articles, all the gold of the offering which they had offered up to the Lord, from the chains thousands and captive hundreds, was 16,750 shekels." Now, a shekel, y'all want to do some math for a second? A shekel is about 11 grams, all right? And if you use today's, well, depending on, well, it varies a little bit. But this is about between $9.3 to $10.3 million in today's amount of gold. It's a lot of money that they're giving as an atonement. And this becomes... Moses and Eleazar the priest took the gold from the captains of thousands and hundreds and brought it to the tent of meeting as a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord. And so we have this first. So this is the vengeance on the Midianites. God said this was going to happen, and it happened, right? Because of what they had done against them. And we'll see more of this in later books, but this is kind of something that when you mess with God's people and you do this, retribution will happen. "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," says the Lord. And this is what he did here in this case. Then we have a situation where, have you ever been traveling before? Traveling, you're like, man, it'd be nice just to stay right here. It'd be nice if you're traveling through an area, I just want to stay here and never leave. Well, that happened for a couple, 2.5 tribes of the tribes of Israel. They get to an area and they decide they're going to stay. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad, an exceedingly large number of livestock, and when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, and it was indeed a place suitable for livestock, the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben came and spoke to Moses and Eleazar the priest and the leaders of the congregation, saying, "Hey, you know, like these cities, we want to stay here. If we have found favor in your sight, verse 5, let us stand or stay in this land given to your servants as a possession, and do not take us across the Jordan. Now, across the Jordan, they're going to do what when they get across the Jordan? What's going to happen over there? More Israelite kung fu, and they're going to have to, like, get everybody out, right? They're going to conquer this nation. So that's what's going to happen. That's what's awaiting them on the other side of the Jordan. These guys just said, hey, don't take us on the other side of the Jordan. They're conscientious objectors. I don't know. No, just kidding. So what does Moses say here? How does he respond to them? What is his objection? Yes. And this verse is rather good. There's lots of lessons developed on this concept. Shall your brothers go to war while you yourselves sit here? There's a responsibility that we have as a community, right? We have a responsibility to one another and to be working together and pulling together in a service to the Lord. And that's what Moses is trying to get them to do. Now, what does he bring up as, like, you're doing this again? What is he afraid they're doing again? Verse 7. You're going to discourage them. Like, who discouraged them before about crossing the Jordan? What's that? The 10 spies that were not faithful to God. And so he brings this whole situation up. Now, as a parent, have you ever been in a situation, or maybe as a child, so we have some of those in the room, been in a situation where, like, maybe you see a situation unfold and you start giving them, like, both barrels? Or maybe you're a child and you did something and you get, like, both barrels from mom and dad about, I can't believe you're doing this, this is happening. That's what Moses is saying right now, okay? Because Moses goes through the whole scenario about how the reason they couldn't have nice things, right? The whole reason why they had been in the desert for 40 years. You guys are going to do it to us as well because you're discouraging the brethren. You're just going to chill here and not go across the Jordan. And so Moses goes through all of this to tell them, you cannot just stand here and do nothing. You can't do this. And so that's the reason why we were in the wilderness to begin with. And so verse 16, they came near to him and said, we will build here sheepfolds for our livestock, cities for our little ones, but we ourselves will be armed and ready to go before the sons of Israel until we have brought them to their place, while our little ones live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until every one of the sons of Israel has possessed his inheritance. For we will not have an inheritance with them on the other side. So that's what Moses is saying. So they make this promise to them that they will do this, that they're going to go ahead and fight with everybody, but they'll make provisions for their families and things to stay behind. And so Moses says to them, he says, if you will do this, if you will arm yourselves before the Lord for the war, and all your armed men cross over the Jordan, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then that's good. But if you don't, verse 23, but if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. That should be something that we ponder a second, right? I'm sure none of us have ever done anything that we knew was wrong in secret and thought, nobody will know. Nobody will know. How are they going to know? They're never going to know. How are they going to know? So we do something in secret, and maybe they don't know. But God said, your sin will find you out. Look over in Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, verse 7. Who do you think we're talking about in Genesis 4? Cain. Is Cain in here? Different spelling. Okay. So this Cain, capital C, verse 5, for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. God didn't regard their offering. So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Be sure lest your sin shall find you out. Here with Cain, God is saying, sin is sitting at your door if you don't do what's right. If you don't master it, you don't master yourself, Cain. Get yourself together, Cain, is what he's saying here. But that is to say, if we don't master the sin that's crouching at our door, who's in control then? That sin, right? And it was very much so in the life of Cain. Look over as well in Genesis chapter 44. Genesis 44. Verse 16. So Judah said to Joseph, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are the Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found. What was it? What did they do that they knew? Did they know who Joseph was at this time? Not yet. No, they didn't. But what was on his mind? What sin was on his mind that the Lord had found out? What they had done to Joseph, right? Throwing him in the pit and selling him off into slavery, lying to their father. All that sin, you know, in his mind had found him out. He didn't know the half of the story yet, right? He didn't even know who he was talking to. But he's saying, our sin had found us out. So here's two stories where sin found them out. And going back to the book of Numbers, chapter 32, he's saying here, you've got to do this or sin will find you out. And this is the very same thing for us. That nature hasn't changed. That's not something that's changed. We need to be very careful with things that we're playing around with, that we don't get caught up in it. Sin may be waiting at our door if we're not careful. And so he tells them, do what you have promised in verse 24. Who has the New King James or King James Version here in verse 24? Does anybody have that rendering, that reading? New King James. What does New King James say at the end of verse 24? Do what proceeded out of your mouth. That's literally what this says. You better do what your mouth has said, right? So that is, you have made this vow, you have done this thing, and so literally, you better do what your mouth has said. And so that's a warning to them about what they needed to do. And so they get this permission to do these things. Now, whenever these things happen, verse 28, Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the households, they're all alerted as to what's going on, and they tell them what's happening. And verse 31, the sons of Gad and Reuben answer saying, as the Lord has said to your servants, so we will do. And so they make this promise to them. And so they, in verse 34, we begin seeing kind of what they did, what provisions were made. The sons of Gad, that they built certain cities here. Then the sons of Reuben built certain cities. And then the sons of Machir, the sons of Manasseh, half the tribe of Manasseh also stayed and built land and built houses and cities and things on this side as well. So you have 2.5 tribes on this side in your Bible maps on the right-hand side of the Jordan that are going to be staying there. And so we have the provisions made for that. Chapter 33, well, it's a lengthy chapter. It's going to be short for us. In that chapter 33, verses 1 through 49, we have a recant of all the places they camped, right? So if they had like a picture on the side of their RV with, you know, all the Negev and all the whole wilderness area, they could put like a sticker on every place where they camped and that kind of stuff on the side of their RV. That's kind of what this is, all right? So we actually, if you took the time, and somebody did, This we're talking about 41 places they camped in the time that they left Egypt to the time that they where they are right now. Where they are right now is their 41st move. All right, their 41st move, which that's a lot of moves, especially when you're moving, talking about millions of people moving them. That's a lot of dust, and that's a lot of times packing up the temple and or the tabernacle and moving them and all that kind of stuff. A lot of logistics. And so that's where we are right now in the plains of Moab. So that's an overview. If you want to go through and correlate that with other events, that'd be a fun study to do as well. We just don't have the time tonight to do that. And so in verse 50, we have this kind of a warning about going in and possessing the land. And there's going to be several more that come up later on, but here's a warning. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, opposite of Jericho, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the land of Jordan into the land of Canaan, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land." That needs to happen. "And destroy all their figured stones, destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places." Just raise the whole thing, right? Just get rid of all those things that you don't need to be influencing you. "And you shall inherit the land according to their families." Again, this goes back to, had they known that larger groups got more land, maybe they would have had more children, right? So this law goes in telling that the larger groups will inherit more land and the smaller will have less, and whatever, according to a lot that will be given. "Those whom you let remain of them will become..." So if you do not drive out, verse 55, "if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land before you, then it shall become about that those whom you let remain of them will become pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land in which you live." Let's fast forward over to Joshua chapter 23. Joshua chapter 23. Where are we on time? Very quickly, Joshua chapter 23. Verses 5 through 13, Joshua kind of his here part of his farewell address. He says, verse 6, "Be very firm then to keep, then do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that you don't turn aside from the right or the left, that you will not associate, verse 7, with the nations, these which remain among you, or mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them, or touch them, or even look at them cross-eyed," is what he's kind of saying here. Don't even look at them. "But you are to cling to the Lord your God as you have done to this day." Do you see the contrast here, the language? Don't even look at them, but cling to God. "The Lord has driven out the great and the strong nations before you. One of your men puts to flight 1,000 for the Lord your God is who fights for you. So take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God, for if you ever go back and cling to the rest of the nations, these which remain among you, and intermarry with them, so that you associate with them, and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive out those nations from before you, and they will be a snare and a trap to you, and a whip to your sides, and thorns in your eyes, and until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you." That is quite a warning, right? It's rather intense. But it's serious, right? It's serious. And so he tells them, don't let those things be an influence on you. You're going into the land where all these influences are, and you need to make sure there are stark contrasts between you and what's holy and to the rest of the people that are around about you. Does that have application for us today? Do we need to have lines in the sand that say we can't go this, we can't go there, we can't even look in that area? Do not go in and be influenced by these nations around about you. We have to be very careful in the land that we live in that we are not influenced. And I would ask you tonight, what practices do you have in place to keep that influence at bay? Because if we're not actively keeping things at bay, then we are being influenced. We are being influenced. How we think, how we talk. All those kind of things are influenced. And there are so many different ways that we are influenced, so many different ways that we're absorbing information all the time, around people all the time. But we need to be different. They went into a land that worshiped certain gods and had certain beliefs and culture and everything, and they had to go in and be like night and day different, stark contrast to those that were around about them. And had to be comfortable doing so. Eventually, they didn't get that way. Eventually, they wanted to be about like the nations around about them. But as they went in, they were very, very different. Would you say that you are different than the nations around about you, so to speak? Or are we comfortable trying to fit in? You see what I'm saying? It's a very, very, very important. God takes it very seriously. When you're His and you're holy, and you're there for a reason, it's very important. Now, that is not to say that it's very different. We're not going in like on a raised earth, scorched earth campaign against Palm Beach County. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying there needs to be a distinction, right, between what is God's and what is not. Those things that are His and ideas and concepts that are His and should be ours, and those things that are not. And any influence that would unduly hinder us to go away that we should not go, we need to make sure that we have barriers in place for those things. Otherwise, as is stated here, it'll be a thorn in our side for the rest of our lives. And so we make sure that we do those things. But God says, if we don't make that distinction, whatever I had planned for them, I will plan for you. So we need to make sure that we make those distinctions. All right, moving on. It's like chapter 34, the borders of Canaan. This is fun when we start looking at the borders, because we don't know, actually, when it comes down to it, because they name things here. All right, so verse 2 talks about this is the land according to its borders, the land of Canaan according to its borders, and he begins to mention certain geographic locations, which we all have mapped in our brains, right? You would know where all these are. Guess what? You can't even Google it. We don't know where all... If you're going to be a Google theologian or a Google archaeologist at this moment and try and Google all these places and find out, we don't know where they all are right now. We don't. And so because of that, I have some pictures for you.
Pictures.
All right, so we have... Like, this is like the max... Some have said that this is the border that God is originally talking about with Canaan. All right, this is the extreme. All right, there are other, you know, dialed back. But because we don't know where all these places are, it's pure speculation as to exactly what border God was talking about. It does seem that it was all the way down to Egypt and all the way up into what we would know as like the upper level, the fertile. Do y'all remember the Fertile Crescent? The Fertile Crescent, when you talked about like ancient civilizations in school. Do y'all remember that? Okay, so at the top crest of the Fertile Crescent might be where the northern boundary is towards the Euphrates and that kind of stuff. So maybe northern as far as Euphrates and southern as far as the Nile or down towards Egypt. But beyond that, the only thing that's for sure, and this one is off on its image, is that he does mention the sea as the border, right? The coastline as far as the border, that direction. So this one's off on that. But this is what it ends up looking like once they do conquer the land and once they go in and actually conquer it. Now, from this picture to what God may have had envisioned for them might be different. They didn't, if you go through the book of Joshua, they didn't 100% drive everybody out. And they didn't 100% take advantage of what God had done for them. And it's like having, well, you probably don't, we don't need Nintendo analogies here, but like if you had 1,000,000 lives and you could go and do as far as you want because you could die and just respawn, and you could go as far as you wanted, and they didn't take advantage of that. They didn't take advantage of what blessings God had given them to go and just take as much land as they possibly could. They're like, this is good, all right? You know, this is good enough. But it's evident that they could have done more. Than what they actually did. And later on, under David and Solomon, they do get more than what they initially conquer. That was not it. But anyway, that just gives you an idea of kind of what the borders are. But it does list here the eastern, western, northern kind of border, but we don't know exactly where those are because we don't know where these places are. That we do know where some of them are, but not all of them. So we can't exactly line those things out. So verse 16 and the rest of this chapter, the Lord spoke to Moses and talks to them about those who are supposed to give out the land, which I'm sure that was a fun job. That would be a great job to be lotting out and handing out land. It wasn't like Oklahoma land rush where you just kind of ran in. They actually had to lot out the land. Chapter 35, very quickly, the cities for the Levites, the cities of refuge. This is a huge thing. We've talked about this in Leviticus earlier, and it comes up again here, that there are going to be cities of refuge. If you want to write out here beside verse 16, Joshua chapter 20 and Joshua chapter 21, that's where you have the fulfillment of these things, the fulfillment of these cities, but a city of refuge. Not only did the sons of the Levites, were they going to get 48 cities because they didn't have any land, it tells us how much area around each city they had for grazing and for their livestock, but among those cities, six of which had to be cities of refuge. What do you think, what does the text tell us here? What are these cities of refuge for? Any guesses, or do you know? City of refuge. If I said sanctuary. Anybody? Nobody? Quasimodo? Okay, I'm sorry. What's that? Yes, so if you've accidentally killed somebody, then you have to go to a city of refuge. Run, because somebody's going to kill you, right, if you don't. And so there's the other person that can come and kill you because you killed there. So it goes in and talks about this. Now, it says over and over again that this is if you unintentionally kill somebody. Now, there's probably the case that if somebody killed somebody, even intentionally they ran to these cities, and then they would have a trial to see whether or not it was intentional or not. And there's some hints here that are given that if you struck somebody with an iron object or you struck them with a stone or a stick, then the blood avenger can kill you because you did that was probably intentional. If you're doing it with these items, then you probably meant to kill them. And if you pushed them with hatred and you struck them with your hand and because you hated them, then you're going to die because you probably meant to kill them. But, verse 22, if you push them suddenly or threw something at them like, here, catch this axe, right? And they, you know, they don't catch it, or they do catch it, not the way you intended for them to catch it, and they die, then you need to run. You need to get to one of these cities, right? And they have them strategically placed throughout the land that, you know, it's convenient, and have a big neon sign, city of refuge. So you run to the city of refuge, and their trial will be done. Now, just because maybe your name is cleared, do you get to leave as soon as your name is cleared? The fact that you're asking this question, Josh, sounds to... No, you do not. You do not get to leave. You're correct. You do not get to leave. When do you get to leave, according to the text? You can't leave until somebody dies. The priest, yes, somebody said it, the priest. When the high priest of that time dies, who's been anointed by oil, when they die, then you can go, all right? So how would you like to be the high priest? You know, there's all these people in these cities of refuge that are waiting for you to die. Yeah. but it tells us that if you leave the city and you're just bebopping around and, you know, you forget, right? And that kinsman or that blood person that's there, that relative, and they see you, guess what? You could die. They could kill you till you die of it. So don't leave the city. And so it talks about these things. And it's interesting that these things are a statutory ordinance, verse 29. And don't take bribes, don't extort anybody for money because of these things. And he says here, verse 34, you shall not defile the land in which you live. Justice must be served in the presence of God, or you'll defile the land. It's a defilement if you defile justice, if you distort justice in any way. Because, he says, I'm in the midst of you, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. Do not defile the land with injustice. All right, so God takes those things very seriously. And then we finish the book with an issue concerning land inheritance. And this goes back to Numbers chapter 27, verses 6 through 8. about the daughters of Zelophehad. Remember, you know, they, you know, they all died, and like, we're not going to have an inheritance because we don't have any male heirs at this time, and so they were able to inherit. But now the question comes up: if they are able to inherit the land on their family's behalf, and then they marry somebody from a different tribe, then that land goes to the other tribe. It goes to their husband, right? It's transferred to the husband, and that means that let's say they're, you know, from one tribe, and they marry to another tribe, and those lands get taken. Then you have like these just random holes in everybody's land, and all the land start looking like Swiss cheese because they start like intermarrying and everything. Basically, said you cannot marry outside your tribe. All right, you cannot marry outside your tribe. So the family trees look like a pine tree with Israel. You cannot marry outside your tribe. So that was their answer to that solution, and that becomes a statute here at the end of the book. All right, thank you very much for your time and patience to the book of Deuteronomy. We are going to start, the book of Numbers. We're going to start the book of Deuteronomy in here on the 21st of this month. Thank you very much.